on.
Oh, hello, Mum. Oh, dear, you haven't been sitting there the whole time, have you?
Well, I didn't know what else to do.
You could put the kettle on.
Well, in a moment. What did they say?
They didn't say much at all, actually.
Oh, they must have told you something.
Nothing helpful, I'm afraid. My age and profession make it possible, but not certain, that I will be called up for military service.
Oh. When will you know?
I haven't the foggiest. You are now as informed as I. Ah, about that tea.
Well, come into the kitchen. Surely they must have said something.
This is your progress report, Wormwood. That he may be called to military service, or he may not.
Yes, Uncle. I had hoped for a more decisive situation. Had he been called up, I could have made much of the forthcoming danger. Had he been left at home, I could have made much of the rejection, the innate feeling of rejection and cowardice. But here I see little opportunity, which is why I asked for your help.
Frankly, Wormwood, this situation abounds with opportunity. I am delighted by it.
Delighted?
Yes. Yes, we want him to be in the maximum uncertainty, so that his mind will be filled with contradictory pictures of the future, every one of which arouses hope or fear. There's nothing like suspense and anxiety for barricading a human's mind against the enemy.
How so?
Don't you understand? The enemy wants men to be concerned with what they do. Our business is to keep them thinking about what will happen to them. Your patient will, of course, have picked up the notion that he must submit with patience to the enemy's will. What the enemy means by this is primarily that he should accept with patience the tribulation which has actually been dealt out to him. The present anxiety and suspense, it is about this that he is to say, "Thy will be done," and for the daily task of bearing this, that the daily bread will be provided. It is your business to see that the patient never thinks of the present fear as his appointed cross, but only of all the things he is afraid of. Let him regard them as his crosses. Let him forget that, since they are incompatible, they cannot all happen to him, and let him try to practice fortitude and patience to them all in advance.
But isn't it impossible for him to know how to respond to a dozen different and hypothetical fates?
It is, but your patient doesn't know that. Listen closely, Wormwood. This is a basic and important spiritual law.
All right.
You'll remember how I explained that you can weaken his prayers by diverting his attention from the enemy himself to his own state of mind about the enemy.
Right.
On the other hand, fear becomes easier to master when the patient's mind is diverted from the thing feared to the fear itself, considered as an undesirable state of his own mind. And when he regards the fear as his appointed cross, he will inevitably think of it as a state of mind.
It sounds complicated. Wouldn't it be simpler to use his general feelings of hatred towards the Germans? Hatred is easy to manipulate. I like hatred.
And there you show your lack of experience and education. What do you mean by hatred? Do you mean those feelings of hatred with its talk of bravado and revenge, which humans are so fond of discussing in their periodicals? You must not rely on those.
I thought revenge was one of our favourites.
But to be sure, the patient can, in his anguish, be encouraged to revenge himself by some vindictive feelings directed towards the German leaders, and that is good as far as it goes. But it's usually a sort of melodramatic or mythical hatred directed against imaginary scapegoats. He's never met these people in real life. They are caricatures modelled on what he gets from newspapers. The results of such fanciful hatred are often most disappointing, and of all humans, the English are, in this respect, the most deplorable milksops. They are creatures of that miserable sort who loudly proclaim that torture is too good for their enemies, and then give tea and cigarettes to the first wounded German pilot who turns up at the back door.
It's disgustingly true.
Do what you will, there is going to be some benevolence as well as some malice in your patient's soul. The great thing is to direct the malice to the immediate neighbours whom he meets every day, and to thrust his benevolence out to the remote circumference to people he does not know. Thus malice becomes wholly real, and benevolence largely imaginary. There's no good at all in inflaming his hatred of Germans if at the same time a pernicious habit of charity is growing up between him and his mother, his employer, and the man he meets on the train.
I understand.
No, you don't. So there's no point in pretending you do. Look, you must think of your man as a series of concentric circles, his will being the innermost, his intellect coming next, and finally, his fantasy. You can hardly hope at once to exclude from all the circles everything that smells of the enemy.
You mean the Germans?
No, not them, you fool! I mean the real enemy!
Right.
He wants virtues to permeate all of those circles within the patient, especially the will, while you must keep on shoving all the virtues outwards until they are finally located in the circle of fantasy. It is only when the virtues reach the will and are there embodied in habits that they are really fatal to us.
I want to be clear. When you say his will, do you mean his resolution?
No. That is often what the patient mistakes for his will. The conscious fume and fret of resolutions and clenched teeth. No, I am talking about the real center, what the enemy calls the heart.
But aren't any virtues a worry to us, even if they reside in the circle of fantasy?
No!
No.
All sorts of virtues painted in the circle of fantasy, or approved by the intellect, or even in some measure loved and admired, will not keep a man from our father's house. Indeed, they make him more amusing when he gets there.